The same for every other story which I've written, with one exception, and that was the title story of the collection of stories called In the Heart of the Heart of the Country. There I deliberately set about reconstructing the facts and details of a town which in fact I was living in, getting exactly the number of people, counting exactly the number of streets that went west, went north, etc., getting exactly the details, the facts. This story is probably further from me as a consequence of its appearing closer to me than anything else, because it was precisely the devotion I had just out of a decision to play to the data that took away by that decision the chance for any manipulations of my own. For example, the more the person is copying exactly the way a table looks, the less room there is for his own unconscious or preoccupations and the like. The consequence was that although this story then seemed to people who knew me and who knew I lived in B, and it was called B because it was Brookston, Indiana, and there were so many people, 1,200, and all the data was exactly right, that therefore that story must be very close, sort of very autobiographical. But as a matter of fact, in my opinion, it's about the least autobiographical story I've done. It was removed by the facts, indeed, moved away. Whereas a piece that is contorted, which nobody could possibly get through, and a thing that's been recently released by Knopf, Willie Master's Lonesome Wife, which is about, in a sense, the things I've been talking about tonight, is for all its contortions, disguises, and so on, the one in which I probably am just most naked and exposed. What I want to emphasize then is that realism, in a sense, autobiographical data in a novel, which we can check and say, aha, he did live here, and he did go down the street, and look how he observed that, there are three railings and so on. We notice, for example, that Joyce was like this. He wanted his details of Dublin exactly right. But all of those details don't tell us a thing about Joyce. What tells us about Joyce is how he arranged the details, the fact, indeed, that he wanted the details right, and the arrangement, the harmonies, and so on, of the structure he builds with them. The rest is a disguise. Whereas, I think, in a book like this, where the contortions are very obvious, in which the author appears constantly to be ducking, that I'm ducking least, I'm most forthright, saying what I think, and so on. But even here, you have to be careful. I think this is true of everybody. When somebody comes up and says, now I'm going to be frank, you know, I don't believe a word of it. They're not going to be frank, they're going to be sneaky. This book, what I tried to do was, again, to stress some of the things I've been saying. The material part of a symbol is as important to it as anything else. Therefore, I wanted, since this book was supposed to be, in a sense, a kind of stream of consciousness, though it's not quite right, of a lady of easy virtue, a former burlesque queen, who was lonesome in the afternoon and entertained gentlemen callers, and so on, that this woman, who of course is supposed to be a symbol for language, the proper manipulations of language, therefore to have intercourse with her was to have intercourse with the medium of language, to make love to her was to make love to language and that sort of thing, that her body was indeed the physical body of the book. Therefore I wanted it sort of overblown, a little garish, a little cheap. I mean, she is herself of that sort, although she's a little past it, and the like. And the typographers did the best they could to present that kind of thing. When this was originally published, our dream was, which we were prevented by Northwestern University, which originally prevented from doing it, was that since this was the body of the lady, to enter the book was to enter the lady. Consequently, you better have a condom handy. So we hope to have a bookmark in the form of a condom. See, and then you could enter safely without getting infected. That indicates the kind of symbolism I had in mind, at any rate, with dealing with Willie Masters' lonesome wife. This accounts for the, in the original edition, there were all kinds of colored paper. One part was so blue, beautifully blue, you couldn't read it, and things of this kind. It was to be an encounter with a text that was trying as much as possible to be as physical as possible, and also to try so that each page physically would stand as a kind of entity. This was a failure because I'm not in any way an artist and didn't know what the hell I was doing, and so what I learned was not to do this again. Nevertheless, I good intentions, but that doesn't pay off. Nevertheless, what I tried to do also in this book was to make a statement, a kind of manifesto, I suppose, about what I thought literature was and its relationship to the author and so on, and the relationship to the reader. Consequently, there are passages which are deliberate attacks on the reader, which I rather forcefully express what I think of him in a certain mood, and so on. This kind of thing throughout. I want to quote to you only the final section in conclusion. Which I suppose sums up what I really have to say. The passage begins with the reference, the lady is speaking, begins with a reference, however, to a ring on the manuscript that's been made by setting down a coffee cup as you were working on your manuscript, and I put that in to the book and made a symbol out of it, so here it is, appears several places, the first reflection is about that ring, which is entitled in this particular place where it appears, The Moon of Daylight. That accounts for the Ben Jonson reference in the first line. What should I call you? Huntress, chaste and fair, my sterile star, the emblem of my afternoons. As you see, its center's empty. No glow there. And I am lonely. This stupid creature who just now has left me, whom I favored with my charms, a bosom born but 30 years ago and plump as ever, round as a pair of pies when I lie down, has not come and gone upon me harmlessly, although he put his penis in a plastic bag like something you'd buy frozen at a grocery. For he did not, in his address, at any time, construct me. He made nothing. I swear, nothing. Empty I began, and empty I remained. Oh, dears, I know, it was a hollow victory, hollowing him. Still, I'm always good, Mum, always fine. I went no farther with him than the suburbs of my body. Thus we never touched, nor would have, though he feared me greatly. When we fucked. Afterward, he carried his seed off safely in a sack. Well, what the hell? He's some hybrid, maybe, strain of burpee, super giant, extra early. So I should, had he not worn his cello guard, have been but 7 months to bud, a week to bloom, and 3 more days to fruiting. This moon, then, is something like me. For one thing, I'm an image. I still reflect the spots which lit me all those years. I turned in them, revolved. You know the way it was. I shook. My hands felt for me, slowly slid along my thighs, so every customer could dream his own were sliding slowly in that sliding place. Poor gentlemen, I'd like to laugh at them because I cannot cry. Well, I'm no longer the nookie look-see sort of tease I was, I can tell you that. I used to sweep my nipples clean and blacken the stage in a single gesture. Their own straining undid them, you know. The starting of their eyes, the stare, it was never as dark as it seemed. Anyway, that's the way it worked. I gave them tantalizing glimpses, passed behind clouds constantly, or simply changed my shape into a mouth, to a curl, to a shiver. Sometimes an actress, shut up in her dressing room, loses herself in her role and emerges a queen. But I molt my dress and panties on the stage and only wish it were another, not myself, that I discover. Then I dispose my flesh to pretense like a paper napkin. Put on passion as I put on paint and powder. Try to believe I've flung my body in the wings and out of sea shot with my spangles. Still, wherever I am, I'm lonely. Night frightens me. I do not watch the moon there. Only by daylight, when it seems almost a tissue, frail and antic, can I bear it and its scrutiny. I want to have familiar things around me when a man is on me. He'll be too strange, too foreign for me otherwise. Something unforeseen might happen. I must have the carpet, its diamonds interlaced and wound with silver leaves and flowers bursting into bloom like bombs. I must have the scratches with which my plum and tawny colored pumps have enlivened the coffee table. I must have that green glass vase the daffodils die in, the books my Miss Pearl Buck I glued up in a stack to stop the door, the photographs of castles which threaten to topple on the radiator, the brass fly, the lacquered dish, the cloudy face of a clock lamp. It is a weakness, but I must have this stupid black slick leather-covered couch, the tarnished fire irons and the sloping piles of tattered magazines I used to cut designs and paper ladies from, the dull, bleak, busy walls like this man's arms around me. I must have the painted ice cream chair, the drop-leaf table, the idle doilies, the dirty ashtray, the pewter mug, the pretty pillow and its corner tassels, and the downcast china baby doll which says Enfant de France. These things crowd into my eyes while it is going on, the jouncing and the ramming. They press close. They fill me better than a man can. They speak to me of value, weigh me down. My fancy cannot sail itself to Spain or dub me a Balkan princess while these buttons dent my bottom or the whiskey snickers in my glass. So I make my love in daylight, in the sight of all their smicker, even though the moon is shining. The watch won't change the gallop of my cowboy or the scintillation of his hair, but my mind can't bolt into the flat, dead-open middle of the night so easily or often over these few fences. It's still and quiet there. Sometimes I hear late buses groan or a lone cab corner noisily. But mostly, though I hug my covers close, my own insides, like craven cuttlefish, cloud ink around me. Oh, be assured that on occasion I am brave. I read John Dryden, hear his shepherd say, "The rest I have forgot, for cares and time change all things and untune my soul to rhyme. I could have once sung down a summer's sun, but now the chime of poetry is done. My voice grows hoarse, I feel the notes decay as if the wolves had seen me first today." And I make a start against the darkness anyway. Then I draw my dreams as if a few white lines brought daylight to a blackboard, successively from star to star in vast dim figures like the zodiacs. To write on such a wall, my honeys, yes, my sweets, my dears, inhibits smirch, enlarges all your members but your soul's conceit, which it ties small with fears like Chinese feet. When a letter comes, if you will follow me, there is no author fastened to it like the stamp. The words which speak, they are the body of the speaker. It's just the same with me. These words are all I am. Believe me. Pity me. Not even the Dane is any more than that. Oh, I'm the girl upon this couch, all right, you needn't fear, the one who's waltzed you through these pages, clothed and bare, who's hated you for her humiliations, sought your love, just as the striptease dancer does, soliciting male eyes for cash, and feeling the light against her like a swelling organ. Could you love me? Love me then. Then love me. Yes, I know. I can't command it. Yet I should love, if ever you would let me, like a laser, burning through all foolish ceremonials of modesty and custom, cutting pieties of price and parentage, inheritance and privilege, away like stale sweet cake to sick a dog. My dears, how I would brood upon you, you, the world, and I, the language. You should feel me moving, my mouth moving, like your better feelings rising. Sheer elation, joy, would lighten you like gas in a balloon. But how many men would screw if there were any likelihood their spermatozoa might, like famished millions in rebellion, turn back to storm the heaven of their manufacture? Why not? So much of it's self-love. Why not infect yourself with your infections? No sacks to send your seed to safety in. Frankly, Mr. Galvin, you are Mr. Galvin, aren't you? Galvin of the shining helm and sample shoes? Well, frankly, Mr. Galvin, far better you than us. I am that lady language chose to make her playhouse of. And if you do not like me, if you find me dewlapped, scabby, wrinkled, old, and I've admittedly as many pages as my age, well, sir, I'm not like you, a loud, rude noise and fart upon the town. But let's not quarrel. Though you'll not be back, your brother will. Tell him he is responsible for me, and that I give as good as I receive. If he will be attentive, thoughtful, warm, and kind, I shall be passionate and beautiful. He should prepare to leave particularities behind, abandon envelopes and photos, trophies of all kinds, the ringing silver voice in which the tinny actor hides, his contraceptive sacks, his dirty pipes, his damn bow ties. For I shall be quite singular enough to suit Sly John the Scot himself, that canny philosopher who taught the truth, though one, was iridescent as a plash of oil and varied endlessly from spot to spot. John Scot the Wise, you may remember, who was murdered by his students, so the story goes, at the Abbey Malmesbury with their pens. Why, I can't imagine. For it was he who, dying of his pen wound, said, "How close, in the end, is a cunt to a concept? We enter both with joy." Then let us have a language worthy of our world, a democratic style, where rich and well-born nouns can roister with some sluttish verb, yet find themselves content and uncomplained of. We want a diction which contains the quaint, the rare, the technical, the obsolete, the old, the lent, the nonce, the local slang and argot of the street in neighborly confinement. Our tone should suit our time, uncommon quiet dashed with common thunder. It should be as young and quick and sweet and dangerous as we are. Experimental and expansive, venturesome enough to make the chemist envy and the physicist catch up, it will give new glasses to new eyes and put those plots and patterns down we find our modern lot in. Metaphor must be its god. Now gods are metaphors. It should not be too cowardly of song, but show its substance, sing its tunes so honestly and loud that even eyes can hear them, and contrive to be a tongue that is its own intoxicant. Full of the future, cruel to the past, this time we live in is so much in blood with possibility and dangerous chance, so mixed with every color, life and death, the good and bad, homogenized like milk in everything we think. New men, new terrors, and new plans. That Alexander now regrets his love of drink. Elizabeth, that only queen, pause for her wig to seek employment, and the swift Achilles runs against his death to be here. It's not the languid, pissing prose we've got we need. but poetry, the human muse, full up, erect, and on the charge, impetuous and hot and loud and wild, like Messalina going to the stews, or those damn rockets streaming headstrong into stars. And thank you.